This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, and I'm Anthony Scoma, filling in for Ross Chambliss. Today we're bringing a full hour of speeches from the Hinckley Institute of Politics' second annual Hip Talks competition, co-sponsored by the Wayne Owens Fund and the ASUU. Held in April, this competition brought together some of the University of Utah's best and brightest students to give two-minute speeches based on the topic of the speaker's choosing. 28 students made it through the qualifying rounds to perform their speeches before a group of distinguished judges for a chance at the cash prize. $5,000 is awarded as the grand prize, with a smaller $1,000 prize awarded to the four runners-up and the audience's favorite. We will air these winners at the close of the hour. To lead this hour's speeches, we'll begin with some of the other great finalists. The first speaker is Leah Thacker, with her speech, Mama Africa.
Ever wonder what the term Mama Africa, where it originated? Ever wonder who she is? Okay, yes, she's the continent of Africa, the birthplace of all humanity, the motherland. But there is another woman who also came to be known as Mama Africa for her fight for the civil rights of all South Africans, alongside the likes of Nelson Mandela. Born and raised a Xhosa woman herself, Miriam Makeba had her citizenship revoked for her fight against apartheid, a system that was oppressive and discriminative of all South Africans, black Africans, in Africa. But Mama Africa was a unique freedom fighter. She was a world-renowned artist and used her music and unique singing talents to publicize the oppression of the black South African in his homeland. Now, the click song, Konkotwani, for those of us who can pronounce it, is one of her famous hits. It's about a beetle and a special sound it makes as it leads children home after playtime. It's also sung at Xhosa weddings to symbolize the couple coming to find each other. But Mama Africa gave it a special meaning when she related it to the struggle of the African people. Who was that metaphoric beetle, and how could that beetle lead them home when their homeland had been taken away from them? Miriam Makeba came to be known as a Grammy Award-winning artist in the United States and even performed for President Kennedy on his birthday while she was in exile. She performed for audiences worldwide and told the story of the struggles of her people to whoever would stop and listen wherever she went. She lived to see the fruits of her labor in 1994 when Nelson Mandela became president of South Africa. Now, the country still has a long journey of healing ahead, but oh, what a boost Mama Africa gave that journey. So the next time you hear the Xhosa click, remember Mama Africa, remember Miriam Makeba. Goodbye, Kotwani.
That was Leah Thacker with her speech, Mama Africa. Next is Leah Hunter's This Is Sexism.
Dear man on the street, when I walk home at night, I am under no obligation to make eye contact with you. You have no right to expect a smile or a greeting. How many times have you walked down the street without choosing to acknowledge the strangers passing by? What gives you the right to expect that I should acknowledge you at all? Don't you realize that my quick pace and forward stare are a form of self-preservation? A personal protection taught to me again and again by a society of rape culture which allows you to maintain every expectation over me and my body. So when I walk past without a sideways glance, and you choose to shout aloud and display your masculinity to your friends as if I could not hear, you belittle me. You minimize my humanity. You objectify and sexualize me. This is sexism. Catcalls are not a compliment. Catcalls make a woman feel unsafe. When I'm walking down the street and a man calls across to me to comment on my clothes or my body, I feel violated. This is sexism. And should it truly be your intention to be a misogynist, then there's no point in you even hearing this letter, but I choose to give you the benefit of the doubt and perhaps educate you that what you said was not okay. Your privilege allows you not to recognize the trepidation that follows the simple decision to walk one block home alone. The need to notify your friends that you made it behind locked doors without incident. The rise in heart rate and the prickle down your neck as you pass a group of men standing on the street. You have the option to leave your headphones in, or maybe check your phone while you walk, or maybe even take a shortcut without choosing to worry about how well lit the street will be. So I ask you, please, remember this the next time you see a woman walking alone. and don't expect anything from her. Just leave her be. Sincerely, Woman Walking Home at Night.
That was This Is Sexism by Leah Hunter. Up next, Ben Davies' speech, The Cure.
Division, animosity, conflict. These are the ailments we as a society suffer. From our civic buildings to our social media, we can witness our illness rage through arguments on immigration, taxes, refugees, marriage, welfare, and even healthcare. As a citizen and as a future healthcare provider, I am extremely concerned about our country's disease of dispute. How can we cure our conflict? To heal our harrowed homeland, we must listen. Only when we stop shouting at each other and start listening to each other will we begin to bring about the cure to our conflict. Listening, learning, understanding. These are the therapies we as a nation need. From our homes to our communities, we all can benefit from each other's views on immigration, taxes, refugees, marriage, welfare, and even health care. When we start listening to each other, we will begin to tolerate one another once again. However, we know we are capable of more, much, much more. We know we can look past our differences to see the similarities that unite us as human beings and as citizens of this great nation. Then together, we can combat our nation's maladies with remedies that are significantly superior than our original individual plans. So to everyone that desires to transform our country's filibustering feuds to constructive conversations, today I present you the cure. The cure to our conflict is this. Listen.
That was The Cure by Ben Davies. Next is Cassandra Ellie's Creating Change the Right Way.
When I was in the 7th grade, my brother came out to my parents and I. Being from a Mormon family with relatively conservative values, you can imagine how difficult this could have been for him. I can't say that I was exactly surprised, and to me, it was just another part of who he is. But the person who had the hardest time accepting this news was my mom. Now, let me first tell you that my mom is the kindest person I've ever met. I could go on and on about her accomplishments, but I personally think that her learning to accept my brother is her biggest one yet. My mom was raised Mormon and is probably the most faithful person in this religion ever. Now, let me also tell you that I don't think the Mormon religion doesn't tolerate people like my brother. He received acceptance and love from many members of the religion. However, because of my mom's old-fashioned views, my brother being homosexual was hard to take in. I remember her bawling the day that my brother came out, telling me that she was worried about his celestial being. I want you to imagine your own parent crying because of something that you are, something you didn't choose and can't change. Wouldn't that make you angry? Not my brother. Not once did my brother say anything of hate or negativity to my mom. No, all he did was love her. He realized that this could take time and that the only thing he could do was be patient and respectful. It definitely wasn't the easiest journey for anyone involved, but change happened. Now my mom picks out boys for my brother to date and supports him wholeheartedly. What I'm trying to get at with this story is the lesson behind it. We live in a world full of hate and people being intolerant to those who aren't like them. Could we get angry? Oh, yes, we could. We've seen events happening everywhere, all around the world, all the time, that are unfathomable, just because someone may not agree with how someone else lives. But that isn't going to cause change. Because of my brother, I believe that the only way to create change is through love and patience. It's through sitting down and facilitating a conversation. It's about understanding and compromises. Because change happens. People learn to accept and love and tolerate. I've seen change happen with my own eyes, and now because of my brother and because of my mom, I see absolutely no reason why the world couldn't change either. Thank you.
That was Cassandra Ellie's Creating Change the Right Way. Up next is Nicholas Steffen's Don't Want to Be Right.
I've been different since day one. Day one, genetically different. It's physical. It's not a choice. I know there's people in this room like me. History has been kind to us. Religious institutions, governments calling us outcasts. You know, not right, not normal. But I think in today's day and age, it's safe to come out and safe to say who you are. And I think I'm going to do that today. I'm left-handed. Now, being a lefty is insanely hard. Daily chores are a nightmare. Pencils, pens, scissors. They're insane. Now, pencils, my hand, after a standardized test, looks like it just finished an 8-hour shift at a coal mine. Expo markers are a real kryptonite. Having to conform my arm into a gooseneck, kind of like this, just to write on a board. The education system is no different than these governments and religions of the past. In third grade, Ms. Acosta noticed that I was doing my cursive writing packet successfully, doing my capital J's like bow ties, my shark fin S's, I was on point. But then she noticed it was with my left hand, made me redo the entire thing with my right hand, and sent me home crying. Kindergarten, Ms. Jensen switched the crayon from my left to my right hand, thinking that would just somehow magically fix the problem. And in middle school, Mr. Larson only accepted math homework with pencil. Now this might seem like an easy request to you, but I just turned in gray sheet after gray sheet. Totally illegible, totally, you know, ridiculous. Now, I'm not telling you this as some pity party, not to feel bad for me, you know, not to convert you to being left-handed, because that's not happening, but I am telling you this to have a different perspective, have a different viewpoint, see things differently. Daily struggles for some are easy for others and vice versa. So again, remember, if being left is wrong, I don't want to be right.
That was Don't Want to Be Right by Nicholas Steffens. Up next, Hayden Howlett's Get Real.
It's 1:30 a.m. in a dark parking lot. And I'm sitting in my car glued to my phone because on the other end of the line is somebody I only met a couple days ago, sobbing uncontrollably. And as I try to calm him down, I'm wondering the whole time, am I part of the problem too? I can think of a few people at work and school that I've built kind of phony relationships with in an attempt to get something from them. Not anything malicious or huge, but self-serving. And I'll bet if you think about it, you've probably done that too. Who is that person in your life? Put them in your mind. You and I, treating people that way, we are part of a problem, even if it's just one person, because what if that person is treated that way all the time? That night, as I listened to my classmate choke out his story, he said, "Everybody in the business school just wants to use me for networking. I've been in this country a year and a half, and I can't make any real friends. I'm just going to quit." And he did quit. And he's not alone. According to the AIB think tank, nearly one-third of all business students drop out, and many of them for that same reason. Fakeness. And it's not just the business school. This happens in every major and in every office. And so I wonder, do you think that we're sometimes forgetting to treat people as people? Well, it doesn't have to be that way. This isn't just a speech competition. This is a forum to think of simple and meaningful ways that we can improve our campus community. And I think we found one. Dropping the fakeness is beneficial for everybody. So let's get real. Thanks.
That was Get Real by Hayden Howlett. Next, Jasmine Nakayama's A Simple Exchange.
I love free stuff. And I think we can all agree the food outside tastes better because it's free 99. Even the samples at Sam's and Costco taste better as you walk around, until you get to the checkout, and they inform you your membership has expired. Would you like to renew it? That's right, I pay to come here. So much for my free samples. Everything requires a simple exchange, whether it's a membership for samples or taxes to help clean our air. And tuition should be no different. I've personally benefited from military service, exchanging my time for experience and a college education. But I recognize military service is not an option nor a desire for many. So I propose this, a simple exchange, 2 years of civil service for 2 years of free tuition at any public institution. 2 years upon graduating high school where you serve nationally. 2 years of helping your fellow Americans. 2 years of helping rebuild communities impacted by disasters, taking care of the homeless and your disadvantaged youth. 2 years of building your communication and leadership skills. 2 years of new experiences, people, places, and cultures. For it is our experiences that shape our perspectives. It changes how we approach a problem and form our solutions. A simple exchange where many can benefit through participation of all. Thank you.
That was A Simple Exchange by Jasmine Nakayama. If you're just joining us, we are airing a full hour of the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour with no breaks. Again this year, the Hinckley Institute hosted its Hip Talks competition, a compilation of great two-minute speeches meant to amuse, entice, and educate. Based on the topic of the speaker's choosing, these speeches were performed to compete for a shot at the cash prizes awarded to the most successful and enjoyable monologue. To return to the speeches, we'll hear next from Aiden Tyler's What Would You Bleed For?
What would you die for? A friend of mine asked me this recently when he learned how much my politics have changed since I left the military. Not counting family or friends, what is one thing you would die for? Well, some things never change. For me, it is basic civil liberties. We live in a constitutional democracy, and the purpose of a constitution is to protect the rights of the minority from the whims of the majority. And within this constitution, to protect these rights is our Bill of Rights. And that First Amendment, the one that gives us freedom of speech, freedom to assemble, freedom of the press, and freedom of religion, are freedoms many people may take for granted, but were radical at the time of their inception. America is land of the free, home of the brave, but what does that mean? Does it take bravery to live here? This isn't Kosovo or North Korea. This is America, home of McDonald's and Mickey Mouse and Walmart. But it does take bravery to live in a country with so many freedoms. When the Westboro Baptist Church protests a soldier's funeral, it takes bravery to say, I don't respect what you're saying, but I won't take away your right to say it. When the KKK marches through town waving a Confederate flag, it takes bravery to say, I don't respect your demonstration, but I won't take away your right to have it. And when politicians want to get rid of marriage equality or stem cell research because of their religious beliefs, it takes bravery to say, I don't respect your beliefs, but I won't take away your right to have them. These civil liberties are so fundamentally awesome. I would not only bleed to protect them, I would make someone else bleed who tried to take them away. I am not a socialist. I think a little inequality is what gives us innovation. And I'm not a libertarian. I think there should be restrictions in some things. But on this, I make no apologies. There should be no restrictions. There should only be one restriction on civil liberties, and that is you do not get to use your liberties to justify taking away somebody else's. Or as the late Christopher Hitchens was fond of saying, the right to swing my fist ends where your face begins. Thank you.
That was What Would You Bleed For? By Aiden Tyler. Up next is Landon Henrikin's I Guess It's Not Okay.
I guess it's not okay for me to be this way. I hear things like faggot, and that's so gay. My friends all joke and call each other these names. I join in ashamed, because at the moment, I like James. My church teaches me that it's a sin, that to be good, here's where to begin, that to be good, it should be repressed, that to be good, you should marry a girl, and you shall be blessed. I guess it's not okay to be this way. Day by day, I live with the shame. I wonder with anger, God, why make me gay? I want to hide it, just be straight. But I decide to walk through Hell's Gate. My parents sit waiting, tears in their eyes. They fear what is coming, I have no place to hide. I finally tell them. I choke out their words. They deny it and tell me, no, that's absurd. I guess it's not okay for me to be this way. My counselor on her clipboard scribbles away. She looks at me sincerely as my world turns gray. She wants to help me change how I feel. But I feel I am dying as I conceal. I guess it's not okay for me to be this way. I tell my parents, I'm done with the talks. I'm done with my counselor. I gave it a shot. They kick me out onto the street. I find that the freedom, it's bittersweet. I guess it's not okay for me to be this way. I met a boy, supportive and kind. I think he loves me, and I'm out of my mind. I made some new friends, and I know they'd never condemn the love that I share with my handsome Prince M. I guess it's okay. It's okay for me to be this way.
That was I Guess It's Not Okay by Landon Henriken. Next is Hui Huan's speech, Where Are You From?
Where are you from? Raise your hand if you've been asked that question before by someone you just met. Well, for most of you, it's an easy question. I'm from Utah, California, Colorado, but you get what I mean. You only need to mention your state and something well-known from that state, and your identity is proven. Well, I'm from Utah. Yeah, but where are you really from? People continue to ask me. The question certainly isn't easy anymore. When my family and I immigrated from Vietnam to the U.S. a couple years ago, like many immigrants, I left everything behind but a broken English and a dream. A dream to find a new home, new friends, new hopes, a new horizon. But my dream quickly became difficult. For quite a period of time, I did not know who I was or where I belonged. Can I still call myself an American, even if I wasn't born and raised here? I love American food more than anything else. I love fries more than rice. I would ask for extra fry sauce on my burger, even when they have already given me 2 cups. I spend my morning weekends drinking cappuccino at Starbucks. I listen to Jay-Z and memorize his rap lines. Is that not American enough? What then is an American? An American is someone who believes in the Constitution, as I gradually realized. This is not where you're from, or the color of your skin. This is not what your voice sounds like, or what your religion is. You are an American because you believe that your freedom of speech and expression should be honored, which is why we're here today. You are an American because you believe in justice and equal protection for everybody under the law. Someone is American not only when they see themselves included in We the People, but also when their status are eligible. So, next time, if someone asks you where you're really from, look them in the eyes and say, we are from the United States of America. Thank you.
That was Where Are You From by Hui Huan. Next is Jenica Jensen's speech, A Party of Eight.
I have 3 younger sisters and 2 younger brothers. The oldest recently started college, while the youngest is still at an age where she thinks the word adultery means to act like an adult. When combined with myself and 2 parents, you have a family of 8. Now, I have lived in Utah long enough to have actually heard the sentence, 8 isn't that many. And I just know there has got to be someone in this room from an even bigger family. I think you'll understand me. For everyone else, the first thing you need to know about large families is they are loud and chaotic. At any given moment, there is somebody to play with, somebody to fight with, somebody to play and fight with, somebody screaming, somebody crying, and somebody laughing maniacally. And on the particularly memorable days, they're all going to be the same person. The only reason any order is maintained at all is because the oldest is in charge by default. At least that's what I always told them. See, when you're the oldest, your duties include not only being the boss, but also being your parents' guinea pig, defending your room from miniature invaders, and learning to change a diaper without the aid of duct tape. They include being extremely protective. Nobody picks on my brothers and sisters, except sometimes me. You would be surprised at how many of the people that pick on my family are adults. When we're out in public, people aren't ashamed of staring at us. They aren't ashamed to count us out loud. They aren't ashamed to straight up tell us that we must be crazy, stupid, anti-feminist cult members, or that we are single-handedly responsible for overpopulation, world hunger, global warming, and the eventual collapse of society. So I apologize for the pending apocalypse. When it comes down to it, though, I'm not actually that sorry. My family might have its issues, but it's mine. At the end of the day, I get to be big sister to Camille, Aaron, Adam, Matthew, and Rachel. And I wouldn't trade that for all the peace and quiet in the world.
That was Party of Eight by Jenica Jensen. Next is Amy Boud's speech, Pornography, It's Time to Talk.
The American Psychological Association stated that 40 to 50% of marriages in the U.S. end in divorce. Now, this is a shockingly high percentage, and someone could give an entire speech on that. But today, I'd like to talk to you about a more hidden issue that's been tearing apart families, yet nobody ever talks about it. That issue is pornography. Now, I'll be the first to admit that pornography is a difficult issue to talk about, and some may say it really only affects a select few. But in fact, the Focus on Families poll stated that 47% of families in the U.S. said that pornography was a problem in their homes. 47%, that's nearly half of all the families in the United States. And what's more, the American Academy for Matrimonial Lawyers stated that the internet was a significant factor in 2 out of 3 divorces. Now, pornography doesn't just affect family relationships. Violent pornography is proven to have played a huge role in the lives of convicts. Famous serial killer Ted Bundy stated in his final interview before being sent to the electric chair that one of the key influences that sent his own sanity spiraling down the drain was an addiction to violent pornography. He also added that of all the convicts that were with him in prison, they all, without exception, shared the same addiction to violent pornography. Now, I'm not saying that everyone who views pornography is going to end up like Ted Bundy, but I am saying that this is an issue that we can no longer keep hidden in the shadows. Pornography destroys relationships. It destroys individuals. I've seen this in my own life, and I've seen it in the lives of those around me, and I invite each of you to think of what you can do today to protect yourselves and your families from the parasite of pornography.
That was Pornography, It's Time to Talk, by Amy Boud. Next is Michelle Lemon's speech entitled Mental Illness and the Illusion of Choice.
When I was 14 years old, I had a supportive family, a great group of friends, even straight A's. But I was dying. Soon, every step began to feel like a marathon, every question like an interrogation, every bite of an apple like a 3-course meal. I was dying. And I blamed myself. One of the most common misconceptions surrounding mental illness is that once someone has been diagnosed, they can instantaneously and miraculously choose to recover. Not only is this perception false, it is harmful. When I was 15, I was diagnosed with anorexia. For the next year of my life, a team of dietitians, doctors, and therapists helped me to recover, but my progress was continually repeated by reoccurring episodes of self-blame. I, like many, had been taught that happiness is a choice. So I hated myself for my seeming ineptitude to make that decision. I now realize that my illness, like all illnesses, was a product of genetic and environmental factors. I did not choose anorexia, nor he bulimia, nor she depression. Mental illness is not a choice, but do you know what is? Love, compassion, empathy. So next time someone comes to you, confides that they are suffering, you can make the choice to help them find the treatment they need. Because while they did not choose to be sick, you can choose to help.
That was Mental Illness and the Illusion of Choice by Michelle Lemon. The next speech was given by Chrissy Penderson. What is rape?
There is a college professor who gave out a survey to 100 of her students. At the top of the survey, she asked, have you ever been raped? Below that, she asked other questions such as, have you ever had a finger or object inserted into your anus or vagina against your will? When she got the surveys back, 2 students said that yes, they had been raped. But according to the rest of the answers, 70 students should have also marked yes. 2 years ago, as I was walking from my car to my apartment, I was approached by a man in a mask. He put a gun against my head, and that night I knew that I had been assaulted. But like those 68 other college students, I did not know that that night I had been raped. This is why it is vital that we put rape education programs into our high schools. Youth need to know not only what consent is, but also what rape is. It took me a year and someone reading me the FBI's definition of rape to realize it. A rape occurs every 107 seconds in the United States. Yet only 68% of those get reported. There is a poll done in high schools where students were asked, when is it okay for a man to hold down a woman and physically force her to have sex with him. 41% of females and 52% of males said it was okay if they've been dating for a long time. 32% of females and 43% of males said it was okay if she got him sexually excited. And 31% of females and 54% of males said this was okay if she was going to, but then changed her mind. We live in a society where we're taught dress appropriately, carry on a taser, pepper spray, just in case. But I want to live in a society where we are instead taught what yes means. While someone may choose to walk home alone, wear that low-cut shirt, or even put their drink down at a party, nobody is choosing to become a victim of rape.
That was What is Rape by Chrissy Penderson. Thanks for listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. This is Anthony Scoma. We are dedicating the full hour to speeches delivered by University of Utah students at the second annual HIP Talks, organized by the ASUU and the Hinckley Institute of Politics, competing for the cash prize of $5,000 and smaller $1,000 prizes donated by the Wayne Owens Fund. The speakers chose their topic and delivered them to a group of judges in the final round of the competition. Now let's get back to the speeches. Up next, Sanchit Srivastava's speech to the Dismal Science.
Recently, I was asked why I teach, specifically why I teach economics. Sweaty palms, shaky knees, an indescribable hollow feeling in the pit of my stomach. My heart does this weird thing. My brain goes into chaos. This is what I experience when I teach. And I wish I could say it was a rare occurrence, but it happens every single day. My association with academia, specifically economics, is best described as accidental. It was not the outcome of some rational, optimizing decision-making process, far, far removed from the sacrosanct cost-benefit analyses at the bedrock of economics. I don't know why my students listen to me. I am a terrible economist by all academic standards. I can't do math. I do not understand economic models, econometrics. My research, I can't do research, and I'm told it's about inconsequential things. It has no real-world policy implications. I do research on things like Goethe's Faust and Marx, Mary Poppins and Victorian economics, Frankenstein and utilitarianism. That's a great one, by the way. I hate rationality, abhor quantification, celebrate chaos, madness, confusion. The more black and white, pristine, placid economics is, the worse it is for me. Because that hollow feeling in the pit of my stomach comes from not knowing why I teach. It's like falling in love. Some people go ski, skydive. I get up on dreary Monday mornings and go teach. And as regards my heart being here and my brain being here, when I teach, they are in perfect harmony and nothing else matters. Thank you.
That was To the Dismal Science by Sanchit Srivastava. Next, Natalie Williams, You Are What You Eat.
They say you are what you eat. And day after day after day, I'm being fed. I'm being fed envy. I'm being fed lust, bodies to covet, comparisons. I'm being fed perfect, unattainable idealisms of body and mind. Society feeds me. For breakfast, I'm fed heaping, steaming bowls of self-doubt. So instead, I'll eat an apple for the day, and that's it. For lunch, I'm being fed every precise detail I must change to fit the perfect mold. For each afternoon snack, I'm fed the hypocritical sayings others feel entitled to hurl at my body. Oh, I wish I was as skinny as you, they say. But real men like curves. Only dogs like bones. Oh, I wish I wore a 00, they say. But thigh gaps are for flamingos. For dinner, I'm fed the acceptable appearances and behaviors it is imperative I maintain. I'm expected to eat up and swallow every bite. Without my meals, I'll starve. I'll slip into the deep cracks of societal oblivion, left and forgotten, glanced out sideways and whispered about in hushed tones, but too ashamed to be spoken about openly. They say you are what you eat. With each bite, the words I'm being fed seep into my being. I'm not hungry anymore, but society feeds me, and society is eating me whole.
That was You Are What You Eat by Natalie Williams. Next up, Valdeke Bokweg, How to Imagine the End.
I have 5 brothers, all of which have a unique and personalized zombie apocalypse plan. One brother's plan is to avoid the zombies by staying on a private jet. Another brother's plan is to outlive the apocalypse by staying on a deserted island. But what surprised me the most was my youngest brother's plan, who's decided to live inside of a bed he's built inside of another bed. This plan is so ridiculous, it doesn't even pain me to tell you that this brother is definitely going to die. I couldn't comprehend how he had come up with such an unrealistic zombie apocalypse plan. But the more I thought about it, I realized he probably just wasn't able to grasp the severity of the situation, which is probably true for most of us. So instead of a zombie apocalypse, I want you to imagine that you're a graduating senior with 1 class left. This class's grade is entirely based upon the final exam. And your instructor has decided that instead of scheduling the exam, he's going to surprise you on campus by jumping out from behind trash cans or bushes. And if he can tag you, you will be required to take that exam immediately. Just like you cannot predict the timing of this final exam, you cannot predict the timing of a zombie apocalypse. You must simply be prepared at any time. To prepare for a zombie apocalypse, you must form study groups, form alliances with talented individuals. The more diverse your group's skill set, the higher your chances of survival. And just like you would do with a real study group, you must constantly be surveying and observing your subject, zombies. Zombies are a potluck of death and disease, and they must be avoided at all costs. But no matter your avoidance tactics, eventually you will be forced to engage the undead in combat. And when you do, it's important to never have just 1 weapon. Would you ever take just 1 pen into this surprise final exam? No, it could run out of ink, just like a gun can run out of bullets or your knife can become dull. And that's why if you prepare for a zombie apocalypse the way you would for a surprise final exam, you're sure to survive. Thank you.
That was How to Imagine the End by Valdeke Bokweg. Next is Belma Boyle's The Invisible Model Minority.
I was working the usual Wednesday evening shift. This had become a weekly tradition as my college president routinely invites dignitaries to help improve our rankings. To show the rise in diversity, he turns to me and he says, Bella, share with us your story. Tell us of how you came to start college in South Dakota at the age of 16. Stunned, I stare blankly because I am uninvited to this ball yet offered up as anecdotal fodder. Once again, the invisible model minority. I must share my triumphs but hide my tribulations. I ponder which story he wants me to share. Do I tell him of my father escaping conscription in Biafra Civil War at the age of 13? He makes it out, earns an engineering degree in England, but chooses to come home to rebuild the country he loves so much. Ignoring self, he dedicates his education and resources to rebuild this country, but it does nothing to protect him as he is eventually left with nothing but fear by thieves in the middle of the night. Do I tell them how I worry for my parents, or how scared I am to return home? Or do I speak of my experiences in South Dakota so far, where I'm required to substitute words like feminist or humanitarian, and I must say merit-driven rather than affirmative action, as I tone down the darkness of my skin to make others around me feel comfortable? Or do I speak about rescinded job offers, canceled interviews, as recruiters repeatedly infer that I would be better off if my grandparents had suffered from Jim Crow rather than colonization? Do I tell him that skilled immigration is an invisible cause and that merit means nothing when you are born on the wrong continent? Bella, his voice drags me back to the present. Share with us your story. Mustering all the positivity that I can fake, I put on a well-rehearsed smile and I say a well-rehearsed story about the engineering child standing before them. Satisfied with this answer, their guilt assuaged, faith in humanity restored, they enjoy the meal I just served them. And I must retreat once again to the shadows, the invisible model minority.
That was The Invisible Model Minority by Belma Boyle. Next, Artemis Sephandonikis' speech, It's All Greek to Me.
It doesn't happen often, but when my family has a reunion, it's like Athens. But in Utah. Most of my family lives in Utah, and they're all Greek. Like, really Greek. When we get together, the men control the living room, and the women reside in the kitchen. It's been this way for as long as I can remember. These gatherings consist of all my aunts constantly telling me that if I don't learn to cook soon, no man will ever love me. Ouch. Oddly enough, I didn't love it there with the women. I wanted something more exciting. So I did the unthinkable. I ventured into the living room. But when I got there, I wasn't really welcome. I was somewhere else other than where my family thought I belonged. You see, in any society, there's a status quo, a standard of the most accepted ways of thinking, doing, and living, one that tends to hold us back and keep us in a little box and not let us be who we really are. People tell us what to do and how to think, and if it weren't for the people that didn't challenge this, we wouldn't be where we are today. What if Walt Disney had listened to his first boss who told him he lacked creativity? Or if Steve Jobs had let society convince him he was a failure? There's something different and unique about all of us, and we shouldn't have to hold it back. So it's time we take action and start challenging and changing the status quo by raising our voice and speaking up for what we believe in, and encouraging others to do the same. Because by challenging the status quo, it's the only way our voices will be heard. So at my next family reunion, I will venture into the living room again, because it is, in fact, my choice where I belong.
That was It's All Greek to Me by Artemis Sephandonikis. To finish off before our prize winners, we'll hear from Kurt Manwaring's Reclaiming My Inner Child.
I was the world's first blind NBA All-Star when I was 5 years old. I out-hustled Stockton, out-rebounded Rodman, and made Jordan look like quite the amateur. Then, as I grew up, my ambition skyrocketed as my salary plummeted, and I became the first blind United States Senator when I was only 8. I told Orrin Hatch to his face, "Sir, my parents voted for you, but give it a couple years, I'm after your job." Now, as I continued to grow, my ambition grew right along with me, and I was the first blind U.S. Supreme Court justice when I was only 16. I asked more questions than Clarence Thomas, not all that hard. And my written opinions made Antonin Scalia himself look boring, dull, uncreative, and unoriginal. Considerably harder. Now I'm 24. I'm alone, cynical, bitter, resigned to the day-to-day game of simply surviving. And I'm wondering, with everything I have, just how this cruel, capricious, indifferent world took away my spark of childlike excitement. Because I will give anything and everything I have to find it again. So that maybe it just might be enough. So that I can start dreaming again. Thank you.
That was Reclaiming My Inner Child by Kurt Manwaring. Now we end this hour with the winners of the Hinckley Institute of Politics Hip Talks competition. $1,000 was awarded to the audience's favorite and the four runners-up. $5,000 was awarded to the grand prize winner. The winner of the audience's favorite goes to Christian Sears' What I Wish They Would Have Told Me.
I will be performing a letter I wrote to myself, my past self, called What I Wish They Would Have Told Me. Here you are, alone, cold, no help is coming. What are you going to do? Tie the noose? Get it over with? No, don't do that. Don't give in. Don't be weak. Pull yourself up, Christian, and stand on your feet. Remember, you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet. That's the kind of mindset you're going to have to solve this. Creative destruction. Love it. Embrace it. The affliction will make you stronger, and the pain is your payment. Don't close your eyes and cover your ears. Don't let yourself succumb to fear. The therapy and pills ain't working, and neither is the reassuring words of love, so take a stand. Do you feel that? Do you see yourself approaching the vision of a charismatic Harden leader who can make the tough decisions? A man to look up to with pride in his stride? His actions speak for themselves. He's got nothing to hide. I know for a fact that dream speaks to you now, and I can tell you what you got to do to get there. Here's how. Own your mistakes and don't make up excuses. Stop telling lies to look better. They're useless. Go ahead, tell your parents that you drink and have sex. The dishonesty makes you want to lift a knife to your neck. Instead of blaming mistakes on your mental condition, why not just stop trying so hard to fit in? You're smart and you're funny and you speak to crowds well. Why are you always trying to conform? What the hell? Have you seen people? They're dumb, always glued to their phones. They think of mediocre jokes and figure better let everyone know. Have the bravery to be who you are, because you're as wonderful as a shooting star. No, really, you're dope, and yeah, you're weird as well, but who cares, you recluse, come out of your shell. Lastly, emotions aren't right, wrong, good, or bad. They just are what they are, be they sad, mad, or glad. It sucks, and I know that it sucks sometimes that you can feel the way you do, but that doesn't really matter. Just let you be you, all right? There's no need for you to keep on asking. Just feel how you feel and keep focused on your actions. Thank you.
That was The Audience's Favorite, What I Wish They Would Have Told Me by Christian Sears. One of the $1,000 prizes went to Kimberly Valencia's speech, Names.
I am an immigrant, an alien, a criminal. You see, they call me a lot of names, but I am not a murderer, gang member, rapist, unlike some would have you believe. I am, however, still a criminal under the eyes of the law, a criminal because I entered this country illegally, a criminal because my parents wanted a better life. My first language is Spanish, and if you listen closely, you can still hear hints of an accent that I have been taught to hate, an accent that gets me called a wetback or a beaner, one that reminds me of my social status in this society as nothing more than a second-class citizen at best. Many recall memories of a tall woman when they first came to America, welcoming them with beautiful words, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free." I do not recall this woman. I remember the heat and the thirst, the rays of the sun burning my skin as if I needed more color, right? I can still hear the voices of the coyotes tell me when to run. Ahí está la migra. They would whisper when they would spy a border patrol truck roaming the desert. Everyone talked about el otro lado in Mexico. That's what they call the U.S., the other side. Everyone yearned to leave Mexico. We all wanted the American dream, to live in a society that accepted immigrants. Little did we know that all these promises about freedom and unity were but a farce. Here I am now, an immigrant standing before you with what sounds like another sob story, but that is not the purpose of the speech. My family and I came from miles away. We feel the late nights, nights spent working and studying just to make sure we have enough to eat, a chance at a brighter future. Do you know what rice and beans taste like to an empty stomach after a long day of school? Like heaven. I guess beaner feels appropriate now, right? I do not take any of the hardships that I have had to endure as disadvantages. On the contrary, I welcome these hardships as lessons and reminders, reminders that I have a long way to go and a rough journey ahead of me, a battle I am ready for. I am an immigrant, an alien, a criminal, a warrior.
That was Names by Kimberly Valencia. The next $1,000 prize went to Hans Leo's The Banana Effect.
Hans, Remy Zero Poker. Okay. AP English, A+. AP US History, A+. B+? You secured the B+ in a mass? Bad boy, you bring great dishonor to family.
This is what normally comes to mind when we think of an Asian father, right? Well, while some of these stereotypes might hold true for my own father, similar stereotypes cause a lot of pain and insecurity for me growing up. See, I grew up in the small town of Pocatello, Idaho. A small community with a population of 90% Caucasian Americans. And because of this, initially all I tried to do was blend in. A great example of this is the fact that I had a legitimate fear of ping pong. For example, every time I picked up a ping pong paddle, I was afraid of that one kid yelling, "Oh no, Hans, you better watch out. That kid's gonna come up and put a whooping on you, boy." And essentially, I viewed myself as a human banana, that is, Asian on the outside, but Caucasian on the inside. Over time, however, I learned to realize that these perceptions were false. It didn't matter what others thought about me, so long as I had a positive perception of myself. And the activity of speech and debate helped me realize this. Besides just making me a better communicator and improving my writing skills, speech and debate helped me find my voice. It helped me realize that it didn't matter how others viewed me as soon as they saw me. As long as I could effectively communicate my true opinions, I had a voice and an impact in society. Now, this is the point that we should all take home. Stop worrying what others think about you. Stop living in fear of not being yourself. And start living for yourself. Start pursuing your own passions and your own interests with all of your heart, willpower, and determination. Because at the end of the day, the only people whose opinions should matter are those you love and those who love you. Thank you.
That was The Banana Effect by Hans Leo. The next runner-up was Dylan Wooten's speech, Seeing Beyond Pink Underwear.
Middle school changing rooms are a place I never hope to be in again. In particular, I remember one day when I was changing from my running shorts into my favorite pair of jeans. My classmates noticed the pink color of underwear I was wearing and yelled out in a chorus, "Huh, gay!" Cue 5 years of me absolutely despising the color pink. Colors tell stories of stereotypes. My pink underwear told a story of femininity that had to do with fruity drinks and impeccable fashion. But I'll let my wardrobe of athletic shorts speak for itself, and oftentimes, these stereotypes are not accurate. So why are they so pervasive? Being a biomedical engineer, I naturally turn to science when I try to answer these questions. So it's no surprise to me that it turns out that a lot of these stereotypes arise from our biological mechanisms used in visual processing. So to understand how stereotypes operate, you have to understand how our body processes visual information. I like to think of visual information processing as kind of an assembly line. First, your eyes are bombarded by millions of light waves. Your retina, the back layer of your eye, takes in this information and sends a signal over to your lateral genucleate nucleus, basically where these neural signals are woven together and create an image in your mind. This image is then sent over to the primary visual cortex, and here is where it undergoes the process of pattern recognition, where these stereotypes and preconceptions are applied. So you're probably thinking, oh great, Dylan, thanks for telling me that these stereotypes are based out of biology and are unavoidable. But to me, this is the most beautiful part about stereotypes. As humans, we are nothing if not completely proficient at overcoming our biological limitations. We've developed planes, cars, and I can even wear contacts to improve my visual acuity. So while we may never be able to completely rid ourselves of stereotypes associated with pink underwear, there's power knowing that these stereotypes are merely biological processes, and like other processes, can be controlled and overcome.
That was Seeing Beyond Pink Underwear by Dylan Wooten. The final runner-up was Alexia Cortez's speech, Hypocrisy.
I'd like to submit to you today that Christians pose a threat to the American people. Christianity has an extensive history of violence. Biblical mass genocides, the Crusades, the Spanish Inquisition, all were done in the name of Christ. In my current sociology of religion class, Dr. Page asked students the following question. If God asked you personally to kill your child, would you? Nearly 70% of the class responded that they would. This means that out of 26 University of Utah students, 19 of them would kill someone if they felt that God had told them to. What happens when that statistic is applied to the population of the United States? Christians make up over 80% of the American population. Imagine that same 80% receiving a revelation to cleanse the nation of sinners and non-Christians. For example, imagine Christians collectively deciding to bomb all schools where evolution is taught. This is why I propose that we have every Christian citizen register with the government and be visibly labeled for easy identification. Christianity clearly poses a threat to the American people. We need to know who these Christians are in order for America to be truly safe. How did my attack on Christian Americans sound? Were you uncomfortable or offended by what I was saying? Perhaps some of you were thinking, but most Christians today don't believe in religious violence. Or, but I'm a Christian and I'm very open-minded. Maybe some of you were even beginning to find a line of logic in my presentation, and that was done in only 60 seconds of propaganda. Propaganda is defined as information, especially of a biased or misleading nature, promoting a particular political cause or point of view. In the U.S., we are bombarded with propaganda daily, even from our government. Now replace the word Christians with the word Muslims. Try illegal immigrants or Syrian refugees. Using any one of those words, does my attack on Christians sound at all shocking or offensive to you? Or does it just sound like what you've been hearing on your TV for the past few months? What if I had given that speech as a man or as a non-white woman? It might surprise you to know that my ethnicity is Hispanic, and I call Peru home. Mi primer idioma es español. When I was proposing that we label American Christians for the nation's safety, based on my appearance alone, did you even consider that I could be speaking as a non-US citizen? How is propaganda really affecting you? How is stereotypes really affecting you? If you find yourself thinking about any of the things I've discussed today, I'd instead ask you to consider a more important question. Who is teaching you how to think? Thank you.
That was Hypocrisy by Alexia Cortez. And finally, the grand prize went to Hillary Nekiema with her speech entitled The Wonderful Thing About Honey.
The beautiful thing about honey is its universal appreciation. Honey is smooth and golden as it dances off your spoon onto your peanut butter toast or onto the curious little fingers of a small child. See, if honey were a person, they would be calm and quiet, and you would be captivated by their golden natural beauty, kind of like a good girl. Honey, even the name is pretty. Pretty, 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 but so sticky. See, if honey were a person, sticky would be life. And life is kind of like when it's 5:05, I've clocked in, and the open sign is on. I stand there at the host stand with a concrete smile on my face as I desperately begin to wonder, are my hopes and dreams in that deep prior? Honey is like when you wake up in a good mood and you pass out free smiles. Honey is like when you're feeling poor, but then you overhear a solid Donald Trump joke and you feel like you just struck gold. Honey is like when I start to think about my father. The conversations in French that he would conduct with family, the roar of CNN and NPR, the smell of his signature cologne concealed within the threads of his freshly pressed button-downs. These little treasures, I promise myself, I will never surrender. They are the motor that continues to spark me. See, when he passed, I never imagined that he'd be taking precious moments of joy with him. I never imagined he'd be taking the dance company daddy-daughter dance with him, or his smiling eyes immediately beside me on senior night, prideful in the stands watching me cheer at basketball games. I never considered that he'd be taking the good luck as I walk out the door on my first day to college. I never considered the notion that he'd be taking the comforting words of a shepherd when I felt as though I was a lost lamb. Each time I have to commemorate the sudden death of my father, the reassurance of my inner weakness cuts me like a blade of grass. I begin to wonder whether or not I am temporarily living someone else's life. I begin to wonder if this stickiness is hiding my shine, when in reality, this little light of mine, you know the rest. So I hold my head up high and I smile everywhere I go, and I treat others how I want to be treated, because I know that no matter how heavy the circumstance, my life remains as rich as honey. Thank you.
That was the grand prize winner, The Wonderful Thing About Honey, by Hillary Nekiema. Thanks for tuning in to this special episode of the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, in which we played a series of two-minute speeches delivered by students at the University of Utah's HIP Talks. Unfortunately, we didn't have enough time for all 28 finalists, but you can hear them at our website at kcpw.org under the Local Programs tab and click on Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. Thanks to the Hinckley Institute of Politics, the ASUU, and the Wayne Owens Fund for organizing the event. And special thanks to Molly Wheeler and others who are great help in making this happen. I'm Anthony Scoma, and this is KCPW.